You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, North Korea launches more missiles and Iran says it's done with parts of the 2015 nuclear deal. We discuss the rising tensions and what the Trump administration is prepared to do about them. First, the history and experience of Native Americans is often reduced to a series of tragedies at the hands of the dominant culture and the U.S. government. Indians are more often seen as being acted upon rather than being the actors in their own story. A new book works to correct that narrative and to highlight the resilience and vibrancy of Native American life in the 20th century and right up to today. David Troyer is an Ojibwe Indian from Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. He's a professor of English at the University of Southern California. A best-selling author, his most recent book is The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. David, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, hi. Thanks for having me.
The title of your book, David, is The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. That's in reference both to the 1890 massacre of Native Americans at Wounded Knee and a 1970 book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. First, David, tell us briefly about that event in 1890.
Well, in 1890, there was a massacre on the banks of Wounded Knee Creek in South Dakota, where between 150 and 250 Lakota Sioux and others were massacred, primarily women and children. And it was a really complicated time. 1890 was an incredibly important year. The frontier was declared officially closed. The reservation system was in full swing. There were efforts underway to deprive existing Native populations of yet more land. Indian boarding schools, federally run and religiously run Indian boarding schools, were set up around the country. So there were all these assaults on Native homelands, on Native families. And in the midst of all of that, there was this awful massacre. And what was going on at Pine Ridge at that time was that Sitting Bull, a famous chief, had been murdered. And everyone was justifiably nervous. And there was also this growing ghost dance movement, this new religion on the plains, which was pretty harmless religion, but it made the government incredibly nervous. And so, you know, if only we learned from the past, because the government kept pouring more troops and more guns into Pine Ridge. And the former Indian agent, this guy named Valentine McGillicuddy, was writing letters back to whatever officials would listen to him saying, don't send guns, don't send troops. If the Jehovah's Witnesses had a big dance, you wouldn't worry about it so much. Why are you so worried about this? Just let them do their thing. Because if you send guns and you send troops, they will inevitably get used. And that's exactly what happened.
And you were actually born in the year that Dee Brown's book, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee, was published. I remember it being a prominent book in the 1970s. It sold more than 5 million copies. It was translated into more than a dozen languages. What influence did that book have for you as a Native American and for your community?
Well, you know, flip forward 80 years between the massacre at Wounded Knee to Dee Brown's instant classic, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. And I never read that book growing up. I mean, it was funny that when I was a kid, it seemed like you could find the same three books in every single Native house that you ever went to for visiting and things like that. You'd find a Bible, you'd find Sears catalog or the JCPenney catalog, depending, and you'd find maybe a book by Vine Deloria Jr., Custer Died for Your Sins, probably, and you would find Dee Brown's Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. It was everywhere. In all households, it seemed like, when I was a kid. But I never read it. And as chance would have it, I read Dee Brown's book in 1990 when I was in college on the 100th anniversary of the massacre at Wounded Knee. And I had really complicated feelings when I read that book, because on one hand, you know, Dee Brown was a sensitive, intelligent guy who devoted incredible energy to bringing our stories to light. And for that, Brown should really be applauded and celebrated. But on the other hand, he begins his book, and the very first page of his book, he says something to the effect of, this book is focused mostly on the Plains Wars, and I start in 1850, and I end in 1890 at the massacre at Wounded Knee, where, quote, the culture and civilization of the American Indian was destroyed, end quote. And then he goes on page two to say, so if you're traveling through a contemporary Indian reservation and you happen to notice the poverty and the hopelessness and the squalor, perhaps by reading my book, you will understand why. And those two sentiments were crushing. So on one hand, I felt lifted up by Dee Brown and his effort. And on the other hand, I felt like he was shoving me and my community, and by extension, Native communities across the country, into an early grave, because I knew, because I'd grown up that way, that we were, if not entirely well all the time, we were certainly alive, and any announcement of the death of our culture and civilization was a little premature.
Well, and one of the points that you make in your book is that while about 150 Lakota Native Americans were killed at Wounded Knee, more than that number survived the massacre and went on to live their lives. And that seemed like a very apt analogy for how the society as a whole has not acknowledged and seen the resilience and vibrant contemporary history of American Indians.
No, you know, people tune out. And it's a source of constant frustration that America only tunes in to Indian stories to basically take their own temperatures. You know, how bad are we, or how good are we, or how bad are things in the heartland? And they'll inevitably focus on Pine Ridge, almost to the exclusion of all other communities, not quite, but, and they'll only focus on terrible stories. And so America is deeply invested in the idea of our death and disappearance. It's one of America's founding myths. It's one of its most cherished ideas about itself, that this was once a land of Indians and it is no longer. Now it's America. And so there's a kind of investment in our continual, perpetual disappearance. And in my work as a fiction writer, in my work as a professor, and now in my work as a nonfiction writer, I see it as my job not just to remind the rest of the country that, yes, we still exist, but to remind myself and to remind my people that we don't merely exist, that our history isn't simply the sum of the injustices that have been heaped upon us, but that we have been actors in our own history. And that's what the book is about, too.
We're talking with David Troyer right now. He's an Ojibwe Indian from Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. And his new book is The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. And David, you traveled around Indian country talking with people to both fill in the gaps of tribal histories and to put individual names and faces on the big events in North American Native history. And one of the major issues of the 20th century touched your own family very personally. And your grandmother was sent to a government-run boarding school. How did that shape your view of your family, of your tribe, and of the larger culture around you?
Yeah, my grandmother was sent to Toma Indian Boarding School in Wisconsin, I should say, when she was, I believe, 6. And she didn't return home till she was older than 10. I don't know the exact age. She left speaking only Ojibwe, and she returned speaking really only English. And of course, you know, being separated from her mother during those pivotal years, you know, did many things to her. And she talks about returning home on the train, and then her mother's waiting there, and everyone's excited, and her mom's crying, and my grandmother said she knew she was supposed to feel something, sadness, happiness, something intense, but she didn't feel anything, and she didn't want to let her mom down, so she poked herself in the eyes so it would seem like she was crying. So of course that boarding school had a profound effect on how she grew into herself as a young woman, how she grew into the role as a mother in her own right when my mother was born. And that gets passed down, right? So this undoubtedly affected the way my mom mothered me. So on one hand, we can point out the ways in which these boarding schools were destructive, but this gets back to my earlier point that when people talk about boarding schools, we talk about them as being merely or only destructive. But there were some unintended side effects of boarding schools which we don't think about very often. So, for instance, you took all these native kids from all these different tribes scattered across the country, and you uprooted them from their families, and you moved them to these boarding schools where they were forbidden from practicing their religions, forbidden from speaking their languages, forbidden from wearing their traditional garb, and punished for doing all of these things, corporal punishment, solitary confinement. You sent them to these schools where there was intense and prolonged physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. And of course, this had some negative side effects, but an unintended consequence of all of this was that you had these kids from tribes that were previously unknown to one another, tribes that had no relationship to one another. And you put them all together, and they suffered together, they learned together, and they built networks. They forged relationships, romantic relationships, friendships. And when they left these schools, they carried those relationships with them so that during the 40s and 50s, during tribal self-determination, when tribal governments were getting stronger and stronger, you had this countrywide network of native people who knew one another, could share resources, could share their experiences, and make our communities and our native nations stronger. So that's not what the government intended. The government intended for boarding schools to be the machine that was going to mainstream native people and then absolve the government of any responsibility to tribes at all by the fact that we wouldn't really exist as Indians anymore. That was the intended effect of schools, but they had unintended side effects, which we use to our advantage.
We're talking with David Troyer about his new book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. He's an English professor at USC and an Ojibwe Indian from Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're Native American, what would you like others to know about your experiences and those of your community? If you're not Native, what did you learn about Native Americans growing up? What messages did you get about their culture and history in school or in popular culture? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with David Troyer about his new book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. He's an English professor at USC and an Ojibwe Indian from Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you're Native American, do you find yourself wanting to correct stereotypes of Indians? How have those assumptions affected you? And if you're not Native, where have you gotten information about Native American life? Or is that a hole in your knowledge? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. And David, I want to move into the 1960s and 70s when there were a wide range of social movements active, and that included Native American demands for respect, for visibility, and for reform. How did the American Indian movement come to be?
Well, the American Indian movement began as a largely urban effort in places like Minneapolis, Chicago, Milwaukee, Denver, and it sort of grew up in relation to, and this is one of the things I talk about in the book, is that when people look at Native history, they look at it by itself as though we're in America, but not of America. But the fact remains that Native communities and Native nations are intertwined with the larger American community and have been since the beginning. So the American Indian movement started in the late 60s and sort of gained strength in the early 70s, but it was, you can't really understand it without thinking about it in relation to both civil rights more broadly and the Black Panthers in particular. Because just like the Black Panthers, the American Indian movement had a kind of militaristic and sometimes violent public face. And that's what the American Indian movement is largely remembered for. It's sort of militant public face. But like the Black Panthers, the American Indian movement was building schools, health clinics, starting neighborhood watches, doing all sorts of incredible grassroots stuff. But it's really known for high-profile takeovers of the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington, D.C., of the village of Wounded Knee in South Dakota in 1973, and a shootout at the Jumping Bull compound in 1975, during which two FBI agents were killed.
And here in Wisconsin, we saw violent clashes in the 1980s and 90s in northern Wisconsin over the issue of Ojibwe spearfishing. How does that fit into the larger picture of Native Americans demanding that treaties and other agreements be honored?
Well, it doesn't. The spearfishing controversies at Lac des Flambeaux and other places in Wisconsin in the 1980s is only loosely tied to the American Indian movement. What you saw there was a real sort of reservation-based grassroots movement where they were going to remind the state of Wisconsin and the United States government of treaty rights, which were never extinguished and never bargained away. Treaty rights which were important to the lives and livelihood and well-being of Native people across northern Wisconsin. And it was pretty violent. There were protests by pretty racist white folk at boat landings when Ojibwe people were trying to exercise their treaty rights. And it's funny how that thing resolved when sports fishermen realized that they had common cause with Native people exercising their treaty rights, because they were all concerned with preserving water quality and access to lakes, and stopping things like the Crandon mine. So that resolved in a really interesting way in Wisconsin.
Let's go to the phones, and Madeline in De Pere is up. Hi, Madeline.
Hello. I was born and raised on the Oneida Indian Reservation, and I actually tape recorded many of the elders in my tribe who went to those boarding schools. And Irene Moore, she was the first woman chairman of the tribe, and she was my aunt through marriage. And I guess I have a whole different take on the boarding schools. We were losing our land so fast to the land sharks because our people didn't know how to read and write. A lot of them didn't know how to speak English. You know, so here were the loan sharks with their just sign up on the dotted, you know, just a lot of them just know how to sign their name, and that was all. And I really kind of rail against people who say nothing good in the boarding schools. And like I said, I actually interviewed them. And it wasn't in our reservation, people were not forced by the government to go. It was decided by the parents and the grandparents.
And thank you for that, Madeline. I want to give David a chance to respond.
Madeline, I think we're in total agreement, to be honest. I mean, you know, like maybe you and I both feel that the story of boarding schools is only ever told as an unmitigated tragedy. And what you're saying and what I'm saying are pretty similar, that they're much more complicated than that. In some cases, Native parents let their kids go and they were happy they were going because there wasn't much happening on the reservation and they needed skills, they needed job skills, they needed English. And it was a good opportunity. Other parents were coerced, and that is a historical fact. Rations were withheld and Indian agents were given lots of enticements to get Native people to give up their kids and send them to school. Other parents were so destitute. They were so poor. They couldn't feed their kids. This happened in my family, that parents understood that their kids would have a better chance of just surviving at boarding schools than if they stayed at home. Other parents, and I know people like this too, hid their children and kept them away as long as they could. Until they were eventually taken away by force from them. So there's a whole range of experiences of boarding school. My grandma, she says it wasn't so bad. You know, we had to fight the Ho-Chunks a lot, but other than that, it was okay. That's what she says. And I think her experience of it is a little more complicated than even she would probably admit to. But Madeline, that's exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about, that we have to look at our history and we have to look at our place in our own history as being layered and complex, you know, and that's the big problem with only telling the story of Native life as a tragedy. Tragedies, you know, understanding our lives as tragedies, turns us into statistics, and it turns our lives into a condition. And what I hope I bring in this book is to the story of Native America, is a sense of complexity, of layering, of details, of contrasting forces, because that's really what life is all about. Life is complicated, and so I'm really glad you brought that up.
Thanks for that call, Madeline. Let's go to Sid in Madison for a quick question. Hi, Sid.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Sorry. Okay, so I was just wondering, are there words that are kind of uniquely American English words that have an etymology that comes from sort of Indian language or?
Sure.
Yeah, and that's a great question because that is part of being a contemporary culture, right?
Right. I mean, moccasin, it's an Ojibwe word. Toboggan, Ojibwe word. Moose, Ojibwe word. Totem is from Dodame, another Ojibwe word. I don't know any other native languages than Ojibwe, so those are just some cognates or some, you know, English words whose, you know, source material is you know, Ojibwe. But even, you know, more broadly than that, like I said before, I mean, people think of Indians as being in America and not of it, but the fact remains that we are part of the fabric of this country, and we have been since the beginning. I mean, during the Boston Tea Party, the colonists didn't just dump tea in Boston Harbor. They dressed up as Mohawk Indians and did so. After the Revolution, when they were looking around for new forms of government, Benjamin Franklin and other founding fathers looked to the Iroquois Confederacy for a model of government. The first test of states' rights versus federal power wasn't over the issue of slavery. It was over the issue of Indian removal in the American Southeast. So since the beginning and up through the 20th century, up through Standing Rock, the protests at Standing Rock more recently, America has always been defined and has become what it is, not in spite of us, but in relation to us. That includes borrowed words. It includes borrowed government systems. And much more.
And that's a great place to leave it. David, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
David Troyer is an Ojibwe Indian from Leech Lake Reservation in northern Minnesota. He's a professor of English at USC and a best-selling author. He joined us to talk about his most recent book, The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee, Native America from 1890 to the Present. It's a bit of a tense time for U.S. foreign policy. Aside from a potential regime change in Venezuela and trade negotiations with China, the Trump administration is keeping close tabs on the militaries of Iran and North Korea. Last weekend, Pyongyang conducted what it called a strike drill that involved the launch of several rockets and a short-range missile. Then the U.S. accused Iran of making threats against American forces and our allies and announced it would send an aircraft carrier and bombers to the Persian Gulf. Iran is now saying it's ready to do away with parts of the 2015 nuclear deal and resume higher uranium enrichment. So how concerned should the U.S. be about these situations and how might the Trump administration respond? Matthew Kranig is an associate professor in the Department of Government and the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. He's also a senior fellow in the Brent Scowcroft Center on International Security at the Atlantic Council, and he served in the U.S. Department of Defense and the intelligence community. He's also written several books, including The Logic of American Nuclear Strategy. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the program.
Let's start with North Korea. This was their first launch since November 2017 when they fired an intercontinental ballistic missile. It came less than 3 months since President Trump met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to discuss denuclearization. Is this a significant setback?
It's something of a setback, and I think it's helpful to put it in a little bit of a broader context. We're trying to denuclearize North Korea. That's been a longstanding goal of the United States and our allies. The Trump administration put in place this maximum pressure and engagement campaign to try to increase the pressure on North Korea to force them to the table to negotiate. We basically got that. They came to the table to negotiate as part of the reduction of tensions in the negotiation. They stopped testing missiles. They stopped conducting nuclear tests. We stopped increasing the level of our sanctions pressure. But then those negotiations have stalled out, and I think both sides are a little frustrated and impatient. And so I think these tests are North Korea trying to ramp up the pressure again on the Trump administration and the international community to try to get us to make some more concessions in these negotiations.
President Trump downplayed the test, saying he thinks Kim understands the economic potential of North Korea and won't do anything to mess it up. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said on Sunday that the incident doesn't change America's approach to North Korea.
We still have every intention of negotiating a good resolution with North Korea to get them to denuclearize. We've known it would be a long path. We've known it wouldn't be straightforward.
What do you make of the Trump administration's response?
Well, we're on this engagement track now. The hope is to get a deal where North Korea agrees to reverse the program. So the alternative to that would be giving up on engagement, turning back to the maximum pressure campaign, more sanctions, more threats of fire and fury. And so I think the administration right now is not letting these tests get in the way of their diplomatic approach. They want to give this a little bit more time to work. So I think it's understandable, although I'm somewhat skeptical that we're going to get much more progress here. I'm guessing that at some point we will have to return to the pressure track if we maintain this goal of denuclearization.
Well, and the Justice Department said today that the U.S. seized a North Korean cargo ship that's long been used to transport Russian coal to North Korea. That's apparently a violation of international sanctions. Does that signify a changing approach?
Yes, I think the United States there is showing that we have options to turn up the heat a little bit as well. Sanctions we have against North Korea are the most comprehensive we've ever been able to achieve. Just in the past year or so, new UN sanctions, new U.S. secondary sanctions. So the economic pressure is building, but North Korea, Russia, China, others have been evading the sanctions through some of these illegal shipments. And so what the United States did today was something we've been threatening to do for a while, which is to seize the ships that are engaged in these illegal transfers. So that would be one way we could increase the economic pressure on North Korea still further, not just in enforcing the sanctions, but also going after those who are looking to evade sanctions.
We're talking with Matthew Krainig right now. He's an associate professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University, also senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. And we were talking about security threats coming from both Iran and North Korea. And speaking specifically about the nuclear threat that North Korea might pose to the U.S. or to our allies that are geographically closer, how serious a threat do you feel that is?
It is a serious threat. According to some estimates, they have dozens of nuclear warheads already. They have ballistic missiles capable of delivering these nuclear weapons in Asia. So two U.S. allies, U.S. bases, U.S. forces in the region are already vulnerable. And they've been working on longer range missiles, including an intercontinental ballistic missile that could reach the United States. Experts disagree on whether they're there yet or not. Some think they already have the ability to deliver nuclear weapons to the United States. My own view is that they're close, but not quite there yet. But the trend lines are clearly in the wrong direction. So North Korea could become only the third U.S. adversary after Russia and China with the ability to threaten nuclear war against the United States. So it is a serious threat, and there's good reason why it's one of the foremost foreign policy priorities of the Trump administration.
Now, the administration in South Korea says that President Trump supports their humanitarian efforts to help feed the people of North Korea. They hope that that will be additional incentive for North Korea to come back to the negotiating table for denuclearization. Do you see that as a potentially effective approach?
So the engagement track, you know, it's much more than just the nuclear program. That's an important part of it. But the United States and North Korea and South Korea are still technically at war. There was a ceasefire after the end of the Korean War, but no peace deal. The North Koreans and the South Koreans both have a lot of forces on the demilitarized zone. And so part of this engagement track of offering a brighter future to North Korea is to promise a lot of other things, a peace treaty, maybe a positive security or negative security assurance from the United States, demobilizing the DMZ, promise of economic aid, humanitarian aid from South Korea. So some of those efforts have begun as part of this engagement track, but there is a lot more that we could offer contingent on North Korea making more progress on denuclearization.
China is also a big player in this issue and in that part of the world. Do you see any impact from the current U.S.-China trade talks and disagreements that could affect the situation in North Korea?
So far, I think there have been somewhat separate issues. The problem we face with China and North Korea is that I think that China shares our basic goal, that they would prefer that North Korea not have nuclear weapons, not have a missile program. The problem is for China, it's a much lower priority. For us, when it comes to North Korea policy, the nuclear and missile program is priority one, two, and three. For China, it's something like priority number four. They want stability on the Korean Peninsula. They're afraid that if North Korea collapses, that they could face refugees. There could be a unified Korea with U.S. forces right on their border, aligned with the United States. And so their foremost goal is really stability on the Korean Peninsula. And so they're not really willing to get very tough with North Korea. They're not willing to enforce the kind of tough sanctions we would like to see, because they're afraid that if they get too tough, it could lead to North Korea collapsing, which in their view is even worse than North Korea with nuclear weapons.
And let's go to the phone, and Dennis in Two Rivers is up. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. I figured this thing could escalate because with China being an ally of North Korea and being against anybody doing business with Taiwan, well, what if the U.S. sends something to Taiwan and the Chinese figure, hey, let's just seize that. Let's just sanction the U.S. and take their ships. So it could escalate.
Thanks for that call, Dennis. And
yeah, I think there is a risk of escalation. And the Chinese have said that if there's a conflict on the Korean Peninsula, that the United States starts or that South Korea starts, China has said that it would live up to its defense commitments and defend North Korea. They've also said, though, that if North Korea is the aggressor, that it's on its own. You know, China has already talked about its willingness to get involved. Some Chinese military experts have argued that China's changed the way it's doing its military exercises to plan for a Korea contingency. The other possibility of a U.S.-China conflict over this would be that if North Korea does collapse, the United States and South Korea would likely try to move north to secure nuclear and missile facilities. China would likely move south on the Korean Peninsula to do the same thing, and also for border security to prevent refugees from flowing across. And so you could have the possibility of Chinese forces moving south, American and Korean forces moving north, and there's a risk for conflict there as well. So there is the possibility of this escalating into, not a high probability, but it's at least possible that it could lead into a bigger regional conflict.
We're talking about the recent security threats from North Korea, and we will move on to Iran soon with Matthew Kranig. He's an associate professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Which do you think is the bigger threat, North Korea or Iran? How would you like to see the Trump administration deal with it? And do you trust the president to handle those issues, or do you fear they'll only get worse? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our discussion of how the U.S. is approaching recent security concerns from Iran and North Korea with Matthew Kranig. He's an associate professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. Join in at 800-642-1234. What should the U.S. do about North Korea's rocket launches? What about Iran's nuclear weapons program? How concerned are you about those situations? And what questions do you have about the U.S.'s position towards those countries? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones and talk to Matt in Johnson Creek. Hi, Matt.
Hi, I would just like to ask your guests, I think people focus too much on the nuclear threat, which is real, but if that problem is solved, North Korea still holds tons and tons and tons of chemical weapons, and I would just like to get your guests' take on that. Thank you.
Great. Thanks for that call, Matt. And Matthew?
Yes, North Korea presents a number of challenges to the United States and our allies. It's the nuclear and missile program. It's chemical weapons, as your guest points out. We believe they have biological weapons. They also have a large military, a lot of conventional hardware massed on the border. So just with conventional artillery, they could do a lot of damage to South Korea. In addition to that, they've been known to transfer sensitive nuclear and missile technology around the world, including building a sensitive nuclear reactor in Syria, and gross human rights violations domestically. Some of the things going on in North Korea, work camps and famines, you know, just as bad as things that have happened in the totalitarian states in the 20th century. So many challenges there. And so because of that, in the negotiations, the international community is saying that the goal is not just the nuclear program, but it's the nuclear program, the missile program, the chemical weapons, and the biological weapons. So we've set a pretty big set of objectives for ourselves. And if we could accomplish that, that would be great. But even if we do, other challenges would remain, including the domestic governance issues. So yes, big challenges. Your guest is, the caller is absolutely right.
Thanks for that call, Matt. And Matthew, let's turn now to the situation in Iran. According to the Trump administration, Iran has been making threats against the U.S. and American allies. The administration hasn't said exactly what those threats are, just that an Iranian official gave the okay for groups backed by Tehran to attack the U.S. military. And the U.S. responded by moving an aircraft carrier and several bombers into the area. How concerned should we be with what seems to be an escalation with Iran?
Well, this is another serious challenge. You know, unlike North Korea, Iran doesn't currently have nuclear weapons, but they do have a nuclear program, a uranium enrichment program, that if they decided to move full steam ahead, they could build nuclear weapons in about a year or so is the best estimate. They also have a ballistic missile program working on longer range missiles. And so they already have the ability to hold most of the Middle East at risk with these ballistic missiles and, again, working on longer range missiles. And then they also have ties to terror and proxy groups throughout the region. So Iran is a major challenge to U.S. security interests in the region. You know, I don't have any insight on this threat, but it seems like there was some kind of specific intelligence of an Iranian threat against U.S. forces. Otherwise, you wouldn't have seen such a large and coordinated U.S. government response to try to deter that.
And Iran says that it's going to walk away from restrictions of the 2015 nuclear deal. What specific provisions are they saying that they're no longer going to comply with?
Yes, well, this is a kind of a tailored response from the Iranians. So as you and your callers likely know, the Trump administration decided to pull out of the Iran nuclear agreement exactly 1 year ago. And Iran, up until this point, has complied with the key provisions of the deal. And just earlier this week, they announced that they're going to stop complying with some provisions, but not others. So they're not pulling out of the deal altogether. They're not racing toward a nuclear weapons capability, but they're kind of cranking up the pressure. And I think the target here is actually Europe, that they're hoping that Europe can save the deal. So the Iranians have said that they're going to stop complying with some small number of provisions now, but that within 60 days, if they don't get significant economic benefits, then they'll start to do more. So I think this is really a threat to Europe. Try to save this deal. Or else we'll ramp up our nuclear program even further.
We're talking with Matthew Koenig of Georgetown University and also the Atlantic Council about current tensions between the U.S. and Iran and also with North Korea. And in return for Iran withdrawing from that 2015 nuclear deal, the Trump administration is imposing new sanctions on that country's steel, aluminum, iron, and copper sectors. The U.S. says that Iran's industrial metals industries make up about 10% of its exports. How much might these sanctions hurt Iran? How big a move is this?
Yes. Well, again, to put it in a bit of a bigger context, you know, the United States does have something of a kind of bipartisan playbook for dealing with regional powers pursuing nuclear programs, kind of a pressure and engagement approach. So as long as the countries are taking steps we don't like, try to increase the economic, political, and military pressure on them, but then hold out the hope for engagement if they're willing to come to the table and talk. So when the Trump administration pulled out of the deal about a year ago, they announced a kind of engagement and pressure strategy. And so this is part of the pressure strategy. The Trump administration's been increasing economic pressure on Iran. And the sanctions have been more effective than I think many people expected. So the Iranian economy is hurting. And so really now the Trump administration is going after, you know, some of the last remaining pieces, the kind of low-hanging fruit of Iranian oil and gas. The Trump administration has been sanctioning trade with Europe and Asia. The Trump administration has already been threatening to sanction. So this is becoming a pretty comprehensive sanctions regime against Iran.
Caller John in Madison said that as far as he knows, the intelligence on the Iran threat came from Israel intelligence. Is that what you have heard as well, Matthew?
I haven't heard that, but that's plausible. The Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service, one of the best in the world. And, you know, for them, this is a top priority. They see the Iran nuclear program as potentially an existential threat. Where the United States, we have to focus on a lot of problems around the world. So I don't have any inside information on that, but that is possible.
Matthew, as we start to wrap up, while all of this is going on with North Korea and Iran, there's also Venezuela, the tariff wars with China. How difficult is it for an administration, for the Foreign Service, the diplomatic corps, to try to juggle all of these things at once?
Well, there is a lot on their plate. And, what's interesting is the national security strategy published in 2017 by the Trump administration said that the foremost national security threat to the United States and our allies is the return of great power competition with Russia and China. So I think many in the national security community are focused on some of those issues, the way that the balance of power has really shifted, questions about whether the United States can continue to defend longstanding allies in Eastern Europe and East Asia. So our strategy documents say that those are the priorities, yet we keep getting drawn into these other smaller but pressing conflicts, Venezuela, North Korea, Iran. I think it's a case of the urgent crowding out the important to some degree, but certainly certainly a lot of challenges facing the Trump administration and the United States and our allies at the moment.
And Matthew, with our last 30 seconds, what are you going to be watching for in the next weeks and months regarding U.S. foreign policy, especially with Iran and North Korea?
Well, I think the one with the where there could be real change is Iran. You know, North Korea already has nuclear weapons, so we're going to continue to work on that. But I don't expect any major breakthroughs in the near term. With Iran, things could get much worse. Iran has made this threat to ramp up its nuclear program if it doesn't get relief in the next 60 days. And if it does that, then, we'll have a pretty serious crisis on our hands. We'll have to raise tough questions about how we address this advancing nuclear program.
Well, Matthew, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Matthew Koenig is an associate professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University and a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He's also the author of several books, including The Logic of American Nuclear Strategy. We talked with him about the escalating situations in both Iran and North Korea and the Trump administration's handling of them.